From high atop Rocky Road in Moab, Utah, it's KZMU News. I'm Molly Marcello.
This is your news for Wednesday, April 8th. It's challenging to conduct a U.S. census in the best of times, but during a health crisis, the Bureau is charting new territory. Today, we speak with Dennis Johnson, Deputy Regional Director for the Denver Region of the Census Bureau, who oversees field operations for 12 states, including Utah. He fills us in on what's changed since COVID-19 and why the short nationwide questionnaire is so important, especially now.
As of today, we're over 45% of all households have responded. So we're moving along in that regard. Wow. And as people are spending more time at home, it may be more on their minds to take care of things like that. So we're happy that they have responded. In fact, in Utah, we've had over half the households respond already. So that's even better. And we're just excited about that. It's one of the, they're in the top 10 of all the states as far as response. So congratulations on that. But we have, obviously we have been impacted by the national emergency. On March 18th, we sent the word out to all of the people that were working in our offices and in the field that we were going to suspend operations at that point for about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, since then, we've suspended for even longer. Of course, at first, we didn't know exactly what our future held. And even currently, we don't know what the future holds. But we are trying to look down the road and do as much as we can, number one, to protect the safety and health of our workers and the public, and number two, to complete our mission, which is to conduct a complete and accurate census of the whole country. And we're kind of trying to mesh those two as best we can and have a win-win situation.
So I know that typically the U.S. Census would be sending field workers to residents that haven't responded, but that's currently not happening because of the health crisis. Is that right?
That's correct, right. Okay. That was part of the operations that we suspended, as well as we have two offices in Utah and 50 offices throughout our region. And we suspended some of the in-office work. We're doing as much telework or remote work as possible. Of course, we weren't prepared with equipment for every single individual. And so some of that work has been suspended or at least reduced in the meantime. But we have every intention of being back to full staff and full operations as quickly as possible when it's safe.
Right. Now, you know, obviously some operations are suspended, but you were saying that people are responding. Do you think the option to do it online has helped the census this year?
Oh, I think without a doubt that has helped. And we live in a world now that is very digital, very mobile. And if someone can do something on their phone, you have banking on the phone. You have, reservations of all kinds on your phone. And so many facets of your life are on the phone. This was a natural because we're not collecting a great deal of information. And yet we know and everyone knows how important it is. So putting the two together, it's great to be able to do something so important and use your phone or your tablet or your computer and make it happen. So I know that has had a big impact. On the response so far.
And, you know, what about timelines? You know, what are you hoping for as far as, you know, people getting on to their tablets, their computers, and responding?
We would love for people to do it as close to April 1st as possible. April 1st is Census Day. That's the day that we use as a reference. And, of course, as most people, as you get farther and farther away, sometimes it's harder to remember what was happening, especially in areas where there's a great deal of change and movement. So we want it as close to April 1st as possible, but we know that it's not possible for everybody. And we also know that in the past we've had to visit households that either don't have access or for whatever reason weren't able to respond by a certain time. And we know that that's going to have to happen too. Typically, that would have lasted through the end of July, and we've extended that to the middle of August at this point, and hoping that by that point in time, we've had the opportunity to for you to respond as well as for us to be able to to help those households that haven't been able to respond yet.
Okay. And you think, you know, depending, obviously you said this, you know, a little earlier, you don't know what the outlook is going to be with the health crisis, but will some of that be reaching out via phone or virtually somehow from the census?
Well, the only virtual reach out we have is really letting people know through media, through social media, through organizations they might belong to, through billboard advertising and those type of things. We won't reach out to people by phone unless we've already had contact and they provided a phone number for us.
Okay.
But at the same time, they will open their Facebook page and there will be a census ad reminding them to respond, or they will go to Instagram or Twitter or any of those social networks that will remind them, hey, we want to do this and it's extremely important. So that's what we hope is happening. And eventually, as we said, we will be visiting households that maybe aren't connected, who don't have internet access, who don't have a smartphone, or maybe who, for whatever reason, don't have the ability to respond. And we will assist them at that point and collect the information with them.
And it, of course, depends on, you know, keeping everybody safe.
Absolutely. That's our primary goal right now, is to keep everybody safe. And yet we're constantly making and adjusting our plans to be able to continue our mission when the time comes.
Now, do you mind speaking to the importance of the census? You know, I'm talking to you from a very rural community with limited healthcare resources, and people are saying, you know, you've got to take the census. Federally funded healthcare institutions depend on this money. Do you mind speaking a little bit to that?
You're absolutely right, and I always talk about the census in terms of two things. First of all, is the money, and you've mentioned that. The money that's devoted to schools, the money devoted to highways, to hospitals, to other healthcare resources, just about every facet of your life, businesses use the census to determine where to locate and determine where they will have a workforce. And every facet of your life is in some way touched on by the census. So that's the money part. And the other side of that is the federal dollars that come back to the states based on population. One of the last estimates was over $675 billion every year is brought back to the states and local governments based on census numbers. Mm-hmm. And that number is only going to go up. The other is power. How much representation do we have in our national government? And how is that representation divided throughout the state and throughout the local communities? How do we determine who's in what district? Mm-hmm. That's all census data, and it's by law required to be census data. So those are two very, very important reasons. But right now, I can think of another extremely important reason. We need to know who's living where, and we need to know where the most vulnerable populations are. Mm-hmm. We need to know what resources they might need. Hopefully they won't, and I pray that they won't need them. But if they do, how do we get those resources to the right places? And it's obvious with some of the hot spots we have throughout our country, what's happening. We have lots of people in one area. We have very mobile populations. We have other situations that are being impacted. And that tells us what to look for throughout the country. Without those census numbers, we wouldn't know where to look. And so this is a perfect example of how important it is to make sure we get a complete count. We know where people are, and we know a little bit about them.
So the county that I'm speaking to you from is called Grand County in Utah. And the last I heard, we were, I think, 24% had responded. I know we're not the highest in the state. We're certainly not the lowest. Are we doing okay right now?
You've actually improved on that. Now, I think the numbers I have are actually a day or two old, but you were already at 31.7%.
Hmm.
At the time, the state was over 40%. So you're running a little slower than the rest of the state.
Okay.
But nevertheless, you were pretty close to where the national average is, and certainly improved over the last number you had.
Okay.
So one of the issues with what our procedures call for, in particular in some of the rural areas, one of the operations that we suspended back a few weeks ago was the one where we deliver census questionnaires to rural households that don't have a street name, house number, mailing address.
Sure.
And I have a feeling that some of the rural counties have been impacted by that. The households haven't yet received a questionnaire. And while they are able to go online and fill out the information based on their address, if they don't have an address that we can pinpoint on a map, that makes it much more difficult to know who responded and where they were. And so until we're able to get back out and deliver those questionnaires safely, they're at somewhat of a disadvantage. So it's not that I'm not concerned, but yet I realize that some of the more rural counties are at that disadvantage, and we will be back to work with them as quickly as we can.
Okay, so they're not going to get left behind, even though the situation...
Absolutely not. We're not quitting until we count everybody.
Finally, you know, what if someone, you know, got the invitation, but they put it somewhere, they can't find it? How do they take the census and, you know, fill it out?
Well, and we sent out an invitation, and then a few days later, we sent out a reminder, and then a second reminder. The fourth time that we send something out, it will actually have the questionnaire with it.
Okay.
So it will have their PIN code on it, and they're still able to go online, call in, or they can fill out the paper form if they choose to. So we will make several contacts to make sure that they have that information.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention about the census, you know, taking it in the West or in rural areas or anything at all?
Well, just we encourage everybody to be a part of it, knowing how important it is, and especially in the rural areas. We don't want any area left behind, and we want everybody to be counted. And secondly, we're not done hiring and bringing people on board. And unfortunately, a lot of people are going through an experience where a job they had is currently not able to they're not able to work. As we start operations up, we'll need people. And they can apply online from home. It's not, they don't have to dress up, go anywhere, impress anybody right yet.
Okay.
And they can still apply for jobs. And as we get fired up and start bringing people back, we will need more and more. So we encourage them to be a part of not just being counted, but also being one of the counters.
Dennis Johnson, Deputy Regional Director for the Denver Region of the Census Bureau. Find links to U.S. Census information in the show notes of today's news on our website or podcast. To battle the coronavirus pandemic, many state governments are ordering residents to shelter in place. That's creating a rift in anti-government circles. Some militia leaders are vowing to openly fight these orders. Others say obey for now, but watch for overreach. They do agree on one thing, though. Don't touch our guns. Reporting from Idaho, Guns and America's Heath Druzin has more.
We're not okay with it. We are going to his house. We're going to go to this director of the...
Ammon Bundy is holding court in a chilly warehouse by the railroad tracks in rural Emmett, Idaho.
Right?
Yes, that Ammon Bundy. He's a leading anti-government activist, and on this day he's rallying people against the stay-at-home order Idaho issued to curb the spread of COVID-19. Among other things, he's threatening to march on the homes of Idaho Governor Brad Little and the director of the state's Department of Health and Welfare.
A guideline would be great, but an order is inappropriate, and it's absolutely unconstitutional and unauthorized.
The scene at the warehouse is like something from a pandemic safety nightmare. Dozens of people sit elbow to elbow, greeting each other with hugs, even posing for pictures with Bundy with an arm around his waist. It's also illegal, according to the emergency order issued by the governor. Bundy's involvement raises eyebrows in part because he's led two armed standoffs with federal agents. And he wouldn't rule out a similar scenario today.
I think that we have to do whatever it takes. I hope that we don't have to go to that extent.
But some in the militia movement see it differently. One of the men who took up arms to defend Bundy and his father against the federal government has broken with Bundy on the pandemic response. Eric Parker is the president of the militia group, the Real 3%ers of Idaho. His phone line was scratchy, but he says we're in the midst of a health crisis.
We understand that this is a health crisis. We would expect everybody to act accordingly.
He's encouraging his fellow 3%ers to follow the stay-at-home order. but he also said his members are monitoring enforcement and documenting abuses.
We believe that that's the possible flashpoint.
A possible flashpoint. What does unite anti-government movements during the pandemic is the importance of firearms.
It feels so good to be living in the American Redoubt.
That's John Jacob Schmidt speaking on Radio Free Redoubt. The American Redoubt, also pronounced Redoubt, is generally thought of by survivalists and militia groups as a region encompassing parts of Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Montana. It's seen by them as a kind of last refuge from societal collapse. There, Schmidt says residents tend to be
preppers, heavily armed.
Todd Savage lives in North Idaho and runs Black Rifle Real Estate, which caters to preppers and followers of the Redoubt movement. He said his business is booming over the past month. And given that his company name is a nod to the AR-15 rifle, it's unsurprising that he thinks guns are essential during a pandemic.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. When somebody's breaking down your door because they're desperate for food, water, or medicine for their family, what are you going to do?
And followers of the Redoubt movement were galvanized by the controversial memo the Department of Homeland Security recently issued, suggesting that gun stores be deemed essential services. It was the latest in a series of overtures to the far right from the Trump administration. Alexander Barron runs a website focused on the American Redoubt.
I support President Trump wholly when he recommended to governors nationwide that things like firearms, gun stores, and shooting ranges remain as essential services for the American people during these times of need.
David Gleddy spent years infiltrating anti-government groups for the FBI. He said some anti-government groups may see the fear of COVID-19 as an opportunity.
It's a true crisis, but it's a great recruitment tool for these militias.
Gleddy said many in that mindset don't recognize the authority of any government officials past their county sheriff. That could mean the potential for violence.
They are prepared if the government does come with law enforcement and try to shut them down. That's where the red line will be.
For now, at least, no one has crossed that line. For Guns and America, I'm Heath Drusen.
That story comes to us from Guns and America, a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. While coronavirus has turned our human world upside down, for wild animals, life continues pretty much as usual. For the past month, sandhill cranes have been gracing the skies of western Colorado as they travel through on their annual spring migration. Jody Peterson, with our partners at KVNF, has more on the large birds, starting with their unforgettable sound.
One of the key stops for migrating sandhill cranes is Fruit Growers Reservoir on the flanks of the Grand Mesa. Groups of migrating cranes arrive in late afternoon and early evening, ranging in number from a few hundred to a few thousand. They feed on grains and insects in the nearby fields, and then the next morning, when the air has warmed sufficiently, they spiral up into the sky and continue their journey north over Grand Mesa. Retired wildlife biologist Jim Durr, along with a few other dedicated crane watchers, record the number of arriving cranes each day on a website, eckertcranedays.com. I asked Jim where the birds are coming from and where they're going.
These are birds that are heading north on their spring migration to their nesting area. They return in the fall and early winter to New Mexico, the Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge, down through there and into even northern Old Mexico, provide a lot of wintering grounds for them to feed. And sometimes in February, they all start flying north and they congregate in the San Luis Valley. At some point, groups start leaving and flying north. The primary stop is Fruit Growers Reservoir, which is in Hart's Basin, which is just east of Eckert.
Where do they end up at the end of their migration?
When they head out from here, they're heading for nesting areas. One of the primary hotspots is Grays Lake in southeastern Idaho. Some will end up in Yellowstone Country. In the fall, when they're coming back, their young are learning to fly, and they're just kind of meander back in smaller flight distances and more stops along the way.
And I understand there's now a year-round population of sandhill cranes near Delta, Colorado, that no longer migrate?
10-15 years ago, there were a few breeding pairs that were hanging down west of Delta. along the Gunnison River. And in the last few years, we've had wintering cranes in the range of about 3,000 staying over and going no further south than there.
And that was Jim Durr, longtime crane observer. Even though the spring migration is nearly over, groups of greater sandhill cranes will still be winging into Hart's Basin for a few weeks yet. And even if you can't go see them right now, due to the stay-at-home order, you can listen to this and imagine how they sound when they take to the sky. The Sandhill Crane audio was recorded by Jeff Reynolds in 2018 at Hart's Basin. For KVNF, this is Jody Peterson.
And that's the news for Wednesday, April 8th.
Get your community-powered journalism Monday through Friday at noon, 7, and anytime online at kzmu.org.